The Book Nook on WISO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from Wright Memorial Public Library, Clark County Public Library, Tipp City Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Washington Centerville Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCune. It's my pleasure to welcome to the program today Matthew Goodman. He joins us on the telephone in Brooklyn. He's got a new book out. It's called Paris Undercover, a wartime story of courage, friendship, and betrayal. Welcome to the program.
Vic, thanks so much for having me. I'm delighted to be on with you.
How did you first hear about this story?
Right. Well, I was sort of, you know, trolling around looking for my next book topic, and I came across an article in Smithsonian Magazine that told the story of this older woman named Etta Scheiber, who was American but who had gone to Paris in 1937 to live with a friend of hers named Kate Boniface, and the two of them together had managed to, according to this article, transport as many as 150 English and French servicemen out of occupied Paris under the noses of the Nazis across enemy lines. And I was really fascinated with the idea of these two women who were really not at all the kinds of women who tend to get written about, you know, in these spy stories. They were not young, they were not glamorous, they were not especially politically involved in any way. You know, two older women, one was 58, the other was 62, living, you know, entirely conventional lives, who, when the time came, managed to find the inner resources to do what needed to be done and to put their own safety, even their own lives at risk to help the Allies. So I was fascinated by that, and that began my interest in the story, which 5 years later culminated in this book.
And once you started digging, you discovered there's a lot more to the story, and the Smithsonian Magazine, did they have to print any retractions after you did your research?
I don't know. The book just came out. You know, basically what happened was that Etta, well, both women were arrested by the Gestapo after 3 months, which was pretty typical at in the early days of the escape lines. You know, the lifespan of those early escape lines was measured in weeks or months rather than years. And after 3 months, they were, in fact, both arrested. Etta was sentenced to 3 years in prison, and Kate was sentenced to death. She was actually the first woman ever to be sentenced in Paris to death by the Nazis. Fortunately, she was not, in fact, executed, but she was sentenced to death. Etta did 18 months in a Nazi prison camp and then was traded back to the United States in 1942 in exchange for a German female spy by the name of Johanna Hoffman. And when she returned to the United States, she was approached by a ghostwriter, an agent and ghostwriter, about the possibility of doing a book about her wartime experiences. That book became a book called Paris Underground, which was published in 1943 and became just a runaway success, a national bestseller. It was on the New York Times bestseller list for 18 weeks. It was excerpted in Reader's Digest. It became the basis of a Hollywood movie. Just a huge success. And that's really what the article in Smithsonian was about this memoir, mm-hmm. which I read, and it's a fabulous book. But, you know, as I began doing my own historical research into the events that were narrated in the book, some of the events I was able to sort of place, you know, some of the characters, they all in the book, they all had pseudonyms, because the book came out during the war, and you know the publisher didn't want to give any aid to the Nazis in terms of information about people who were still over there. But there were certain things about the book that I couldn't identify. And it became more and more troubling that I was writing a historical account of these events, and I just couldn't locate any of, you know, these particular things. And little by little, and we can talk more about how this happened if you'd like, but little by little, as I sort of went about my research, it began to come clear to me, that in point of fact, much of the material in this memoir hadn't, in fact, been fictionalized. That this book that had sat for 18 weeks on the New York Times nonfiction bestseller list was, in fact, largely fictionalized. And that much of what had been claimed in Etta's name had not, in fact, happened. So the book that I had started out writing ultimately turned into a different kind of book, one that not only discusses the very real courage and heroism that Kate and Etta had displayed in their real life escape line, which they really did do, but then what happened later with the publication of this largely fictionalized memoir, and what were the consequences of that publication. That's a story that has never been told before.
I appreciate the care that you're exercising here, and I'm going to try to demonstrate the same care as far as not spoiling it for readers, because the way you've structured this, it starts off and Etta is coming back to America. It's during the war. The time frame on this is important because when Etta was living there in Paris, the U.S. wasn't in the war yet. It was 1940, and she was an American, and so America was neutral, which changed the thing. And also, she's Jewish.
Right.
And there's a lot of other components, a lot of other elements, and I'm going to be very careful about this. But I do have one question, and maybe this is just the devil in me, but did your agent pitch this book to Scribner?
No. That is a devilish question, because Scribner was the publisher of Etta's original book, Paris Underground, a book that claimed right at the very beginning in an author's note that all of the events described in this book are true, when in fact that is not the case at all. No, I've been fortunate enough to have the same publisher, Ballantine Books of Penguin Random House, for the last three books, and so we just went straight to them, and they were good enough to accept this book. However, I will say that the proposal that I pitched to them and that I sold the book on is a very different story than the book that ended up being written, because, you know, when I wrote the proposal, I was operating under the assumption, the same assumption that everybody in the last 75 years has been operating under, which is that this memoir that Etta wrote, which is an incredible book, you know, I was just assuming that it was true. And so I was, you know, pitching a story about two courageous women who were involved in a number of these kind of almost Hitchcockian cat and mouse escapades with the Nazis, and, you know, did all of these kind of really amazing things. And that was the book that I pitched. Ultimately, you know, what I found was that all of that is true, and there's more to the story than that. And ultimately, to me, what started out as just a story of courage and daring and heroism ultimately becomes that and a larger, more complicated story, a story of friendship and betrayal and unforeseen consequences and means and ends. Ultimately, it's a story, I think, of redemption, personal redemption. And And so I definitely went through a period when I realized that I could not depend on the memoir as my primary source of information, which I had been assuming I could do. There definitely was a period of what the old commercial called agonizing reappraisal, you know, and there was a period where I was wondering, do I have to return the advance to the publisher because I can't write the book that I proposed? But ultimately, I figured out a way to do it because I figured out that it wasn't really possible to understand what had happened between Kate and Etta without also coming to grips with the publication of this memoir and what were the consequences of the publication of that memoir. And so, you know, that became a focus of the book. And, you know, the second part of the book is really about the publication of the memoir. And then the third part of the book is a recapitulation or really a description of what happened to Etta's friend Kate, who was really the mover and shaker of this escape line, really a woman of remarkable valor. And, you know, what happened to her after the trial and after she sent off into Europe, Eastern Europe, as part of Hitler's Night and Fog program for the most dangerous political prisoners. And then, you know, what happened to her later on in her life. It's all really quite amazing, I think. And that's a story that's never been told either. And by the way, a story that Etta herself did not know when she wrote Paris Underground, because that book came out in 1943. And at that point, Kate, no one knew if Kate was even alive or dead at that point. No one knew what Kate's fate was at that time. So even Etta did not know what had become of Kate.
As readers, we don't know if Kitty or Kate is alive or dead. You're listening to the Book Nook on 91.3 WYSO, fact-based journalism in service of democracy. We need to take a break, and we'll continue our conversation right after this. You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. My guest today is Matthew Goodman. He joins on the telephone in Brooklyn. His book is Paris Undercover, a wartime story of courage, friendship, and betrayal. I think an important thing for people to know, and I'm sure we have some historians out there who know this, but I'm guessing the majority of our listeners are not aware of the configuration of France during this period. This is a big part of the story, the way that it was in zones.
The Nazis entered Paris in June of 1940. And shortly after that, Paris was, as you say, divided into zones. There was actually what was called the line of demarcation that basically split the country essentially into two zones. There was the occupied zone and the unoccupied zone. Paris was in the occupied zone. And so basically what happened was that there were a number of Allied servicemen who had been trapped behind enemy lines. Once the British had evacuated at Dunkirk, a number of these servicemen had not been able to get out, and they were just sort of wandering around in occupied France. They were hiding in the woods. They were being sheltered by sympathetic farmers and so forth, looking for a way to get out, looking for a way to get out of occupied France, to get back to unoccupied France, and from there to North Africa and to back, you know, back to England. And so what Kate Boniface did with the help of her friend Etta was to essentially create from scratch, from nothing, an escape line that began with a priest by the name of Edouard Grenier, who was sympathetic, who knew of the location of a number of these soldiers who were hiding. And he and his colleagues would bring the men down to Kate and Etta's apartment in Paris, in the 17th arrondissement of Paris. where they would shelter them, and then obtain for them fake identity cards, which were necessary to travel. And then from there, the men were put on a train, which brought them to a town called Libourne, which was right on the border of the line of demarcation, where they had made contact, Kate Arnetta had, with a man by the name of Elie Tessier, who was really a sharecropper. You can call him a farmer, but he was really a sharecropper who had a little boat. And he would bring the men down the Dordogne River and then bring them on foot across the line of demarcation. And from there, they would take another train down to Marseille, from which point they could then take a boat either to North Africa or directly to England. And there were really dozens. I identified 20 English servicemen by name in the book, at the end of the book, in an appendix with their units, the men who were in fact saved by Kate and Etta, many of whom, by the way, went on to have really quite distinguished wars. You know, they didn't just go back to England and set up a sweet shop in England or what have you. They went back into the war and performed valiantly. One of them ended up becoming a general, in fact, Brigadier General Derek Lang. But, you know, a number of them, you know, won medals for heroism in battle. And in their careers, you can actually see the concrete effects of Kate and Etta's heroism in support of the Allied cause. And after the war, Kate, in fact, received the highest medals of honor from both the English and the French governments for her valor during the war. You know, this was a story that had not ever been told before.
Uh-oh. Did you just admit that she lived through the war? Oh, can't believe it. I can't believe you.
I guess I did.
I can't believe you did that. My guess is Matthew Goodman. I've been tiptoeing here. My guess is Matthew Goodman. Well, we're talking about Paris Undercover. That's fine. You're the writer. You can give away whatever you want.
Yeah.
My favorite, you just mentioned this fella, this sharecropper. I loved this character, this guy. He's a World War I veteran. He'd been terribly injured by German poison gas during World War I. He didn't always charge for his services to take him down the river and to get him across that line of demarcation. But sometimes he would charge 50 francs. He ended up getting put on trial along with the rest of the gang. What were there, about eight of them that they put on trial?
Well, they appeared before – I mean, it was really a show trial. It was a Nazi military tribunal that lasted an afternoon. So I guess you could say it was a trial.
Okay. Well, this guy, he was a great character. And, of course, he was a real character. And it's just – it's quite a story. It's definitely espionage. And before they met the priest you mentioned, they actually had – engaged in some smuggling already. Can we talk about that first smuggling event and their car and the unique features of this vehicle?
Yeah, that's a great point, Vic. Yes, they had, before they met the priest, they had indeed engaged in some really high risk smuggling of their own, again, spurred by Kate. I should say, just as sort of a bit of background, that these two women who were good friends, who lived together, Etta was a widow, an American of Jewish descent, as you mentioned, who was from New York originally. Kate was an English woman who was married to a Frenchman, was actually separated from him, and so she had this big apartment in Paris that she was living in alone. And when Etta's husband passed away in 1937, Kate invited Etta to come live with her in Paris, and she did. The two women were very different in terms of temperaments, even though they were good friends and very similar in certain ways. You know, they were both older women. In 1940, Kate was 62, and I'm sorry, Etta was 62 and Kate was 58. You know, many of the contemporaneous reports referred to them as elderly, which, you know, I found objectionable being somebody of that age as well. You know, they both loved Paris. They both were foreigners. They were not native French women. You know, they were intellectual. They liked books. They liked movies. They had a close circle of friends and so forth. But in terms of their personalities, Etta was someone who was enormously shy. She was afflicted with terrible anxiety. She had all of her life been afflicted with anxiety. Probably related to that, she suffered from high blood pressure. She was a little on the, I guess we would say, on the plump side. She had lived a remarkably sheltered life. She had never lived outside of a 5-square-block radius on the Upper East Side of New York. From her birthplace to where she lived with her husband, it was all within this 5 square blocks of the Upper East Side. She hadn't worked for a living since she was about 21 years old. All of her married life, she had been a housewife. She had mainly spent her evenings going to the opera or the symphony with her cousin, Irving Vile, who was one of New York's top classical music critics. So she was a very shy, retiring person who had lived a very quiet life. Kate, on the other hand, was a very independent-minded person, very bold, something of a risk taker. She had married young and then had divorced her husband. This is in the 1920s. That was extremely rare for an English woman to do at that time. She had then had a child out of wedlock with her Italian lover, with whom she didn't even live in Rome, whom she had met when she and her husband had been posted there. He worked with the British embassy. And so she had, you know, a child out of wedlock with this Italian man. She had run a business of her own. She had owned a dress shop in Paris. This is at a time in France when women were not allowed to control their own finances. They couldn't, you know, own a bank account without their husband's name on it and so forth. She owned her own car, which was extremely unusual for a woman at that time. In fact, she didn't even just drive a car. She drove an ambulance during the war. So she was really someone who was very unconventional and was very, very strong-minded and courageous. So this is the long way around to answering your question, which is that one day when she's reading the Paris newspaper, she saw a classified advertisement that had been placed by a number of French soldiers, French officers, who were a Nazi military hospital in the town of Doullens, north of Paris. They had placed the ad sort of as a way to tell their families that they were alive, that they had been wounded, but they were in fact alive. And she noticed that one of these names seemed to be an English name. It was a Captain Hunter. And Kate became very intrigued by this. And she worked for the Red Cross, which allowed her to bring supplies to wounded men. And she made contact with this guy and asked him if there was anything he needed. And he wrote back. And the two of them, Kate and Etta, went up to this hospital to deliver some supplies to this captain, Captain Hunter. Or he might have been a lieutenant, actually, Lieutenant Hunter. And while they were there, they were chatting, and Kate said to him, "Would you like to get out of here?" And of course, Etta felt her heart just drop because she knew she could sort of foresee what was going to happen, you know, once Kate said that, because once Kate put her mind to something, she was, you know, undeterrable. And so Kate said, would you like to get out of here? And Hunter replied in a sort of a typical way, which was to sort of laugh and say, madam, you're very kind, but I assure you there's no way that you can get me out of here. And she said, I think you're wrong about that. And what ended up happening, and again, I won't go into too many of the details, but what ended up happening was that they got him a pair, a set of civilian clothes, and they got him out of the military hospital, and they hid him in the trunk of their car. Now, they had a model of Peugeot car that had an unusual feature, which was that the trunk was not actually in the back of the car. It was beneath the rear seats of the car. So it was sort of hidden out of sight. You couldn't really see it from the outside. And what they would do was they would put the soldier into this little space beneath the rear seats of the car so that he couldn't be seen. And that's how they got Hunter out of the hospital back to Paris. And then another British colleague of his who was in that hospital as well, by the name of Gordon Hood Cree, they did the same thing. And in fact, it was really a remarkable incident. And this really did happen. They had Hood Cree in the trunk of the car beneath the rear seat, and they were driving back to Paris. And along the way, they got waved over by a pair of Nazi officers who instructed them to bring them to the next town or several towns over to get a ride to where they were going. And Kate and Etta had no choice but to say, okay. And these two Nazi officers got into the back seat of the car and sat there with this escaped British soldier literally at their feet, just beneath the seat. And they drove that way with, you know, Etta barely breathing, while Kate managed to keep up a conversation to keep them occupied so they wouldn't hear any possible noises from underneath. And that's how they brought this guy back to Paris. So they did some really quite remarkable things on their own, even before they managed to hook up with the priest Edouard Renier and the man that you mentioned, this very courageous passer by the name of Elie Tessier, who was the sharecropper who delivered the men by boat, and who met a shall we say, in a star-crossed fate.
Mm. This second fellow, when they picked up the Germans, this poor guy, he's got a terrible leg wound. He's in there trying to be quiet, and it gets even worse because later on that same trip, if memory serves, the poor guy has to change their tire, but we'll leave that to readers.
Yeah, after they dropped the Nazi office. This all happened. This really did happen. I spoke to – well, he wrote an essay about what had happened after the war. And then I also spoke to his daughter and grandchildren, and they described how he had told them about this incident. Yes, what happened was that once they had dropped them off and they thought, okay, now we have clear sailing back to Paris, they had their tire blew out, and these women had to try to fix the tire on their own, and they were unable to do so. And eventually he had to get out and fix the tire. And while he was doing that, a Nazi officer came over, and Kate had to kind of shoo him away, saying that they didn't need any help. So yeah, that was quite an eventful adventure.
It really is. The book is Paris Undercover, A Wartime Story of Courage, Friendship, and Betrayal. Matthew Goodman wrote it. He joins us on the telephone in Brooklyn today. And we have one more segment coming up. And during that segment, we're going to tell you about some events coming up in March with Matthew right here in our local area. You can meet him. You can even get his autograph in a book if you're at one of these events. And we'll fill you in on all that information right after this. You're listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and my guest on the telephone today in Brooklyn is Matthew Goodman. His new book, just out, is Paris Undercover, a wartime story of courage, friendship, and betrayal. And Matthew will be in our area for some events coming up in March. And Sinclair is having a writer's workshop, and it's going to be on Friday, March 28th at the Dayton Arcade. And he's going to be the keynote speaker. He's also got a signing that afternoon. And my understanding is that this is an event that's free to the public, but I believe you're going to have to register. And I have a phone number for you to call and get information about this. Once again, that's Friday, March 28th at the Dayton Arcade. Matthew will be there as the keynoter and also signing copies of his new book. And here's the number. Get out your pen, 937-512-3070. That's 937-512-3070. And the following day, on Saturday, March 29th, he'll be here in Yellow Springs. And he's got an event at the Greene County Public Library here in Yellow Springs. That's right on Xenia Avenue at 3 o'clock. He'll be, I assume you'll be giving a talk and doing a signing?
Exactly. I'll talk about the book, and the books will be on sale thanks to Epic Books of Yellow Springs.
And you have a Yellow Springs connection, don't you?
I sure do. Actually, a couple of them. I love Yellow Springs, and I happily served for a number of years as one of the nonfiction faculty for the Antioch Writers Workshop, which I loved and I wish would come back. And I still have, you know, a number of friends and former students and colleagues in the Yellow Springs area. And it happens that I married up in the sense that I married into a Yellow Springs family. My in-laws, the Schwerners, Steve Schwerner, who is living now in Brooklyn, was for many years the host of a now, I think we can say now, legendary jazz show on YSO. That is, I think, still fondly remembered by many people in the area. So I love Yellow Springs and Dayton, and where I've been also on several occasions. I'm really looking forward to being back there.
Well, when I came to the station in 1993, Steve Schwerner was one of those guys that had seen everybody, that was worth seeing as a jazz musician. He was incredible.
Oh, my God. Are you kidding? Absolutely.
He hosted Alternate Takes, and we used to have some great chats about jazz. And one other note, they did apparently revive the Antioch Writers Workshop last year, and I'm assuming they're going to have another one this year here in Yellow Springs. So,
That's great to know.
I don't really have information on that, but I believe the college did revive it last year, and they did have it last year. So just – I'm sure there's people out there listening go, what's he talking about? You know, it's
– Okay, well, that's
– Yeah, it's been on hiatus, so to speak, for a number of years. Let's get back into this book, Matthew.
Sure.
There's so much here. And when I read the title, when it referred to betrayal, I had a totally different – conception of what that betrayal would be. I assumed it would be something revolving around the fact that these two women were betrayed by somebody who ratted them out, and that's how the Nazis busted them. But the betrayal is something very different, and it's a real surprise. It's a real twist. And I love the way you structured the book, the way that you take us to where we realize what really happened to Kitty, but we have to earn it.
Yes. I think that that's right. I think that there are all kinds of levels of betrayal in the book. And again, I don't want to spoil anything, but I will say that Kitty is betrayed by Etta at a certain point in the book. I would say not intentionally on Etta's part, but in point of fact, she was betrayed. And I think that Etta herself was betrayed as well, not by Kitty, but by men who were more worldly, more wealthy, more sophisticated than she was, and who convinced her to kind of go along with something that I think she did not entirely understand and was not really equipped to say no to. So it's a subtle story. It's a complicated story. I don't mean complicated in the sense that you can't understand what's going on. I just mean that there are a number of ways to interpret what happened. And yet I think that that whole notion of betrayal is a key element in the story as it actually happened, not in the way that it was portrayed in the memoir.
I did enjoy reading about this literary shark tank and these guys who took advantage of Etta. And you mentioned earlier in the interview something that I learned about in your book. I was not familiar with this. When it came to women like Kitty and that death sentence being commuted or whatever, it went all the way up to Adolf Hitler. And in the book you mentioned, and you mentioned this earlier, night and fog. And I think this is an interesting concept. I had not heard of this.
Okay. Yes, night and fog. Nuit et brouillard, as was said in French. This was a policy that was instituted by Hitler himself. And as far as we can tell, Kate's sentence ultimately went all the way up to Hitler. And in fact, went all the way up, amazingly enough, to the Pope, who issued a plea of mercy on her behalf to the Nazi regime. Kate, as I mentioned earlier, was the first woman who was sentenced to be executed in Paris. This was in January of 1941. Her sentence was commuted. The death sentence was commuted by Hitler, who issued an order that female prisoners were not to be executed because he was afraid of creating martyrs for the resistance. And instead, they were going to be treated, along with a number of male prisoners, as what were called night and fog prisoners. That's a line taken from an opera by Wagner. Richard Wagner, of course, was Hitler's favorite opera composer. And the idea is that they are going to just poof, disappear into the night and fog, meaning that they would not be killed, but they would be transported deep into Nazi territory in Eastern Europe. Kate ended up in an area called, in southern, I guess it was Silesia, Lower Silesia was the name of the area where her prison was located, the prison of Jaur. But the idea was that it was even more terrifying to have their fates not be known. They were not reachable by letters or packages. The International Red Cross could get no word to them or from them. They had just disappeared, and no one knew what was happening to them, behind the Nazi fortresses. And that's what I endeavored to try to find out and to recreate exactly what happened in these prison camps. These were not death camps like Auschwitz and so forth. These were prison camps where the women were put to work, working for the Nazi military machine, and of course treated horribly. And Kate, when she emerged from the war, weighed, I think it was 73 pounds, and had suffered all sorts of horrible treatment at the hands of the Nazis, but managed to emerge alive and undaunted and unbowed by what she had gone through during 3 years of the most extreme horror. And I think it's really a testimony to this remarkable spirit of this woman, Kate Boniface, who deserves, I believe, to be better known than she is. She herself was someone who tried to deflect praise or deflect honors, saying, you know, well, this is just what one did. But in point of fact, she was really a remarkable person. I'm glad that I've been able to tell her story.
And these poor women, as the war is drawing to an end, they're imprisoned in Silesia. And the Soviet Red Army shows up to liberate them. Oh, joy. Oh, mm-hmm. Oh, there's some darkness in here. And I want to talk about one more thing, one more topic before we let you go. In 1940, as the Nazis moved into France, we have a situation there where they actually were changing some laws. There was a lot of anti-Semitism. And I'm a person who's always amazed by how history seems to keep repeating itself. People change laws. People take away protections for people. I see a lot of this going on today, and it certainly was going on then. Do you have any thoughts about any of that?
Yeah. No, that's certainly true. I started this book in the last year of the Trump administration, just before the pandemic hit. In fact, I had to do a lot of my research during the pandemic, which was a challenge in its own right. But I was fascinated by the notion of these two women who were not, well, let's just say they were unlikely heroines. They were not necessarily the women who you would have predicted to act in a heroic manner as they did. They were ordinary women, older women, living entirely conventional lives. And when the time came, they found it within themselves to, they found the inner resources to act courageously against the oncoming tide of fascism. I was fascinated by that. I was fascinated by the question of what was it about these women that allowed them to act in a way that many other people did not. And now here we are in the first year of the second Trump administration and, you know, getting hit by a wave of new laws, as you said, many of them quite restrictive and potentially illegal. You know, the question becomes again, how does one respond to that, the time in which you find yourself? That's a question. I don't have an answer to that particular question. My response is simply to show the case of these two women who did what they needed to do under the circumstances. And I think that stories of people who resist authoritarianism and deepening social injustice are always important and perhaps even more important now than ever.
I agree. My guest has been Matthew Goodman. His book is Paris Undercover, A Wartime Story of Courage, Friendship, and Betrayal. Tell us about some of your other books.
Sure. This is my fifth book. The last four have been what I call narrative histories. When I say narrative history, I mean that it's all true. It's nonfiction, but it hopefully reads like a novel. You know, it's novelistic. I myself was trained as a fiction writer, and I tried to use a lot of the techniques of the fiction writer in order to tell this book, you know, in terms of characterization and narrative and authorial voice and, you know, vivid sensory detail and so forth, to help a reader not just to understand what happened, but to really feel what it was like. You know, I wrote a book about Nellie Bly and Elizabeth Bislin's race around the world in 1889, called 80 Days. And, you know, my favorite responses from readers are the ones that say, I really felt what it was like to be in Hong Kong in the year 1889, or to be inside the mansion that Jules Verne lived in at that time. Or my more recent book is called The City Game, which was about a basketball team in New York in 1949 and 1950. And people say, I really felt what it was like to be living in New York at that time, immediately after the war. Or in another book, Living in New York in the Year 1835. So, what I was really hoping to do with this book was to give a really vivid sense of what life was like in Paris, both in the really wonderful years before World War II, where Kate and Etta were living there and taking their dogs for walks in the Bois de Boulogne and so forth, and going out to great restaurants and going to shows and so forth. And then what it was like as things began to tighten and darken, what it was really like to live under the occupation. That's really what I'm trying to do in my work.
Well, mission accomplished. We really appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on. This has been a really great discussion.
My guest has been Matthew Goodman. His new one is Paris Undercover, a wartime story of courage, friendship, and betrayal, published by Ballantine Books, not Scribner. And you will be in our area in March, and I'll give you that information, listeners, one more time. Get out your pens, because the Sinclair Writers Workshop, which is happening Friday, March 28th at the Dayton Arcade, Matthew will be the keynoter. He'll be speaking at 10:30 that morning, and he has a signing at 3:15 that afternoon. And this is free and open to the public. So if you want to participate in this, you need to contact them and let them know that you're interested so they can have room for you. And that number is 937-512-3070. Once again, it's open to the public and free. That's the Sinclair Writers Workshop at the Dayton Arcade, March 28th. That's a Friday. And the following day, Matthew will be in Yellow Springs for an event at the Greene County Public Library here in Yellow Springs. That's on Xenia Avenue, and that's at 3 o'clock on Saturday, March 29th. He'll be giving a talk, and he'll be signing copies of the book. They'll have books available for sale at the library. And we love the Greene County Public Library. There are our lead underwriter here on WYSO on this program. And I think it's just fabulous that you're going to be having you in Yellow Springs, Matthew. It's really, really great to know. And thank you once again for your time and for your interest in being a guest on the Book Nook.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And I look forward to meeting some of your listeners when I'm in town next month.
I think there's a very strong chance that you will be meeting some of them. I think they will be turned up for that. You've been listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. My name is Vic McCunis, and we have over 1,100 interviews archived at WYSO.org as podcasts. You can listen to them at your leisure, at your convenience, anytime you please, and we will archive Matthew's interview up there when we get around to it. It won't happen right away, but it'll probably take a week or two. We'll put it up there. So thanks for tuning in. And for the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis.